From VinePair's New York City headquarters, I'm Adam Teeter.
And I'm Joanna Chirino.
And in Seattle, Washington, I'm Zach Jabal.
And this is the VinePair Podcast.
What day is it?
It's Thursday.
I'm so disoriented.
That was a test. That was a test, Adam.
That's also just why I just said this. No, I'm just kidding. First of all, you know, it's been a week, you know. Got a lot of reaction to the gin and tonic episode.
Yeah.
Both lots of positive and a few kind of negative, but, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. People can have their feelings.
Yes.
You know. But, yeah, heard from a lot of people at some of the larger alcohol companies, too, like big people on the strategy side, et cetera, saying, like, yeah, they had tried. They've seen this discussion happening, like the gin and tonic is – it's been happening for like the last 10 years that the gin and tonic's like trending or going to trend, and they've had brands try to attach themselves to it, and they just haven't had the kind of success, you know, building a brand behind the drink as they have with other gin cocktails. So I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. And also it's not the same for every market.
It's
obviously
not the same for every market. Yeah. You know, some markets I think do like the gin and tonic, which is great. I just think as a national trend and drink, you know, that's why we were looking at the data and national data, you know, it's hard. But anyways, whatever. And then got some really great feedback from the wine episode as well for Monday, the cult wine episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think a lot of people did. It's funny to me how people were surprised at how expensive these wines are. So I shared your reaction, Joanna, like, oh my God.
I think if you're not in it, like, and you're not aware of it, it is pretty shocking.
Yeah.
Well, and I think there's also, you see people who kind of are surprised that that's the, like, cellar door price, right? Essentially, like, it's not
right.
We're used to seeing kind of high-end pricing for wine for secondary market stuff.
Secondary
right?
market, yep.
But the idea that you would be someone who's just like, yeah, sure, like every year I will give you $600 to $1,000 for each bottle of wine, and I'm going to get multiples. Yeah, I think that is surprising to most people.
Yeah, I agree, because I think also it's the same for like spirits, right? Like, there's the MSRP. And that seems reasonable and fine, but then the secondary market pricing is like crazy. But yeah, I think, yeah, really interesting world.
Super interesting world, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think it's crazy. So what have you guys been reading on the site?
We have one fewer day to pull from now.
I know, and I'm going to go back almost a full week. Because I think the most important thing that published on the site over the last week was Dave Infante's hot take from last week about the Bud Light fiasco, and in particular the ways in which it is another example of this kind of strategy that you see kind of right wing, I could call them activists, provocateurs, whatever, trolls,
trolls.
take up in the idea of sort of finding these seemingly very innocuous bits of, I don't know, they're not even, I mean, again, the whole thing that about the whole Bud Light controversy that's ridiculous is, you know, it started with something so benign, so, I mean, basically just a trans person who like Bud Light as a brand acknowledged existed in a very, very small way, and turned into this like brand crushing, well, or at least crippling fiasco. And again, Dave gets into a lot of it in the piece. He talks a lot about how, you know, a chunk of the blame, certainly a good chunk of it, belongs with AB InBev for their kind of bungling of handling this and taking these very disingenuous criticisms and complaints with it. You take them at all seriously. But I think it's also important to note in here, and Dave makes mention of this too, that part of what happens in these situations, and he talked about, you know, Gamergate being kind of the example of this, is that it doesn't take very long for a very small kind of instance, or not even legitimate complaint, but just one thing, to become a sort of swirling nexus of all this grievance and protestation. And companies and brands are just still seemingly ill-equipped to look at all this and essentially say, like, this is bullshit. Like, we don't need to engage with this, because at some point it does take on a critical mass of its own and goes beyond bullshit. And I think that's the hardest part, is I don't know that there's a great answer for how to kind of like short circuit this kind of grievance politics. I mean, again, we're not a politics podcast. So I'm not going to get too deep into it, but I do think that there's a lot of interesting takeaways from this. And if you haven't read it, you should.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting because a brand like Bud Light is not impervious to this stuff, right? Like it actually affected its business.
Yeah.
What about you, Adam?
So I was interested in the Tokyo reclaiming its crown as Asia's best cocktail city. It's funny because everyone's talked so much about Singapore for so long, you kind of forget. And you also forget that, you know, just for me, thinking about the story as a whole, that like also in the U.S., a lot of the Tokyo cocktail culture is what influenced U.S. bar culture in terms of like the resurgence, right? And even today, even the tools on our bar, a lot of them are actually Japanese made bar tools that are like, you know, reproductions of the tools that were used in America in like the Roaring Twenties. And so I thought that was a great piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was trying to find out if there was a real answer. There wasn't, but that's okay. I read Hannah's piece on talking to Soms about whether it's a red flag if an older vintage on a wine list is less expensive or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because like you see that a lot, especially at, you know, restaurants where maybe they have stuff that people didn't order, but then they got a new vintage of something. And so I get that question from other people too. Like,
is this bad?
Is this bad? Yeah. Like, and I think that like the best solution here is like, you just got to talk to the person on the floor and hope that they've tried the wine recently. That's the only thing that like, again, we've talked about here. That's an issue I've found is that a lot of the lists that still are somewhat like not left over from COVID, but some of the bottles that are on the list because there was this, you know, gap in COVID and maybe they're pricing it to move, or they don't believe based on reading vintage charts, whatever, the wine is as good as it could be anymore. They priced more cheaply, but then you find that the staff on the list hasn't tried the wine or isn't familiar with the wine, right? Because they don't have the time and there aren't as many like wine professionals on the floor that are trying these wines often. So I don't know, sometimes it is a crapshoot. I've definitely played that game a few times. It happened recently actually at a nice restaurant here in the city where one of the wines we were looking at was from an older vintage but cheaper, and the somm was kind of like, I don't know, like give it a go, and we did and we liked it, so who cares? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
interesting.
That's funny.
So it's not always that it's just gonna be, because I feel like also like if they knew for sure it was gonna be bad, right, Zach, then take it off the fucking
take
list.
What are they
supposed I'd to hope so
do?
You know, like if like, oh well, it's a Premier Cru Burgundy, but it's a crapshoot, it could be dead, then pull it off the list. You know, don't sell that one for 120, other one for 150. Like, it's a younger vintage. Like, maybe just pull it off the list.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's a crapshoot. It's always about, like, well, it depends on what you like.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyways.
Yeah. I really liked, I like Jake Emmons' piece that you mentioned, the Tokyo piece. I also really liked Adam Reiner's piece that published on the site earlier this week about the physical toll that bartending takes on mostly in high volume bartenders who have been at it for many, many years. But I don't know. I feel like that's something that we don't really talk about too much as an industry, in addition to kind of the, you know, mental health toll that bartending takes as well. But this piece really focused on the physical toll and the injuries, and the, you know, one example is just like a torn vocal cord and other types of things that people, I think, just don't think about. And getting the take from a few, you know, veteran bartenders, how they're not able to, you know, they consult now because they're not able to actually bartend anymore. So yeah, I thought that was a really great piece, kind of bringing light to something that we don't really talk much about. So
great.
Yeah.
So Joanna, you have
I'm setting us up today.
You have our piece today. You have our conversation.
Yes.
And you're ready to go.
We're trying something because those are my favorite topics where we get to drink things along.
Oh, great.
With our conversation.
Not usually mine.
No, they're not. No, yours are the hottest takes.
No, because you bring in like the stuff that I think is going to make me feel sick. Because you want to try the weird shit. Like spice.
Anyway,
Coke.
I think it's good fodder for conversation.
Let's go.
So there was an article recently in IWSR Drinks Market Analysis called Who's Winning the Moderation Trend. Thought it was a really interesting piece. But there was one part of it that kind of piqued my interest around an emergent segment of functional beverages. And I'll read from the piece, alcohol adjacents, quote unquote, with active ingredients such as CBD, adaptogens, or nootropics that claim to offer health benefits, stress reduction, mood alteration, and pleasure, is beginning to attract younger consumers, Gen Z and millennials in particular. So I'll read further. According to IWSR data, the purchase of cognitive enhancers has increased over the past year, driven by growth in Australia and the U.S., where up to 29% of millennials have made purchases in the category. So I think this is really interesting, this idea that basically this piece is saying that, or it's some people's opinion that this segment could provide a challenge to alcohol consumption, right? Particularly with younger legal drinking age consumers. This is something we're talking about often. Why do we think, I just wanted to talk about it, like, why are younger consumers totally fine with drinking these kind of weird unknown beverages that aren't really regulated, that promise to enhance and change your mood and alter you in some way, but you know, alcohol's poison and I don't drink alcohol.
So,
and I think that's so fascinating.
I do too. It's really funny because I had a very similar conversation yesterday with a guy who, like, you know, is an investor, and he invests with a bunch of different people who are all finance guys that have made a lot of money in private equity and stuff. And he was saying that for a while they looked pretty seriously at a Cava brand.
Okay.
Not Cava like the wine, Cava like Cava, like the, it's another one of these like adaptogen substances that like gives you this euphoric feeling and makes you feel kind of drunk. And there's a very famous Cava bar in the East Village. I think it was the first one.
How do you spell that?
I think it's K-A-V-A-A or something. Someone's going to send an email and correct me and be like, he's wrong. Okay. Also, Tim talked about it on Cocktail College. But I think that like the biggest thing about it that he said was interesting was that it gives this euphoric feeling. Mm-hmm. But there has not been a lot of research into Cava. And he said that like why they didn't invest is because there has actually been, from the limited research that there has been, there are people that have uncovered that they think Cava can actually be even more damaging to your liver than alcohol. So I think that, like, this is a little bit of the less you know, the better you feel.
Yeah. Ignorance is bliss kind of thing. Yeah.
Because alcohol has been more studied than probably any other substance, than maybe tobacco, in terms of substances that are drugs, mm-hmm. right? There's been a lot of funded studies, both by the alcohol industry, which we know funds it, to make sure that the studies are positive, as well as the medical health industry, to understand a substance that we ingest pretty much daily once we're of legal drinking age for most people who are normal drinkers.
Yeah.
In the same way that we've studied a lot about sugar and caffeine and things like that. And so because of that, like, with the good comes the bad, right? We are going, we've seen now there's a lot of pushes for there to be other studies with alcohol to show how it impacts our mood or how it impacts our social behavior. Does it help us? Is it more likely to help us feel loose in terms of when it comes to dating? Does it help us take risks in business? Does it make us more social? All these things that we haven't studied, but we've studied the health effects of alcohol. Mm-hmm. And we know that there are some potentially positive and also potentially very negative effects of alcohol. And that's because of decades and decades and decades of research.
Yeah.
This to me is like the supplement market.
Or like the hangover market.
Yes.
Yeah, hangover supplements.
Where there are a few people who are claiming they've run these studies and what this feels the most similar to me about and what scares me in the supplement market as a whole is like it's completely unregulated.
Yep.
Even all these vitamins that people are being told to take. And, you know, I on occasion at around, let's say, 10 p.m., when Naomi's decided to go to bed and so I'm not going to watch anything else and Essie's, you know, we've had this conversation. Like, it's like when it's the time when, like, you should go to bed but you don't. I'll scroll Reels or TikTok. And there are these – mostly Reels now because, you know, TikTok kind of scares me. But there are these health influencers that are either these doctors or, you know, even Huberman, who we've talked about on the podcast before, who had that amazing profile written about him in the New York Magazine.
Yeah.
He is now a crisis PR firm trying to fix it and trying to sue New York Magazine. He just literally said we all know, which is he's a horrible person. But they convince you that they've done all this research on their own and that, like, they're biohacking their body with these supplements. And no one knows what they're doing. They're like, I mean, I saw this one guy that was like, he's a doctor. I'm saying doctor with air quotes because I don't know like where yeah. you guys agree. I don't know. I mean, was he a failed doctor? Like, I don't know. Did he have any patients? What was his bedside manner? I have no idea. But he's like, what I tell everyone to do is like, you know, you need to, if you want to biohack and live forever, you should ask your doctor for this specific blood test where they check all your levels of like, you know, this, and then I just supplement. Like, no one even knows if our bodies break down the supplements and take them in any meaningful way. Yeah. In all honesty, we don't, but like, we're all being told to take all this stuff. None of those supplement companies are regulated, so we don't even know how the provenance of the supplements that they are producing and selling. And I think the same is true for these adaptogen drinks. It's like, we actually don't know what any of this does, but it does make some people feel kind of interesting. But we don't know what the effects are of ingesting, and looking at the kin that we're about to have, a ton of reishi mushroom, L-theanine, and L-tryptophan. We actually don't know what it means to ingest all of this stuff repeatedly on our bodies.
Right.
And so that's what kind of freaks me out.
So I want to add a couple of things here that I think are, to me, interesting and important when talking about this whole kind of milieu. One of them is that I think these drinks and maybe the broader supplement / adaptogen conversation is just a recurrent trend in culture, right? I think you can think about it happens every so often where there becomes a sort of groundswell of conventional science, conventional wisdom about food, drink, et cetera, is about medicine, et cetera, is wrong, is, you know, too tied to corporate interests, is all these things. And what actually, you know, the sort of real fount of wisdom is, you know, whatever, you know, traditional medicines or things from other cultures, et cetera. And this has occurred in waves over the last couple of centuries, really, especially as you saw, you know, Western cultures come in contact with other cultures that had different, you know, used different drugs and had different foods and all that stuff. And almost every one of those things has been held up as a, you know, sort of cure all, as the great new thing. And in some cases they've been truly pretty powerful. And in other cases they've been not so great for people and all the things in between. And so I think there's an element of, you know, novelty and a lot of people having distrust in these big institutions, which again goes far beyond this specific industry, but plays into it. And I think candidly, COVID is a big part of this. And I think that for a lot of people, the mix of the social effects of COVID and the way in which it brought a lot of people, you know, there was a lot of quote unquote doing your own research around COVID, and remains a lot of that, has again created a platform and a sort of permission structure for people to sort of say, well, you know, I'm gonna, you know, all of these things that are, again, kind of cultural institutions, and alcohol is one of those, are, I don't know, I'm going to do my own research, such as it is. And again, I think there are reasons why it's interesting and perhaps even worthwhile to look at some of these other substances and say, hey, you know, there are perhaps reasons to consider destigmatizing them in certain cases, certainly studying them, having an understanding of how they affect bodies and brains and all that kind of stuff, mood, etc. But at the same time, yeah, I think there are a lot of people who are inclined to believe that something being unstudied and unproven is a positive and not a negative. And I'm not quite sure that's a great position to take.
Yeah, I think that, I'm curious to know what you guys think. Like, I kind of classify these somewhat with like the rise of NA. As like non-alcoholic drinks and that category. And I think that for a lot of people, like these drinks kind of promise a lot, right? I think that's one thing. Like Adam mentioned that he and I have Kin Euphorics Light Wave Grounding Calm in front of us right now. And this one...
I need grounding calm.
Right, yeah, now. Basically promises, you know, to calm you down. And hold on, I was reading it. You know, chill for conscious connection. Think naked forest bathing at midnight. Like, lots of stuff on here. It also says that the statements have not been evaluated by the FDA.
Yeah.
And it's not, this product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. But I do think that there is this promise that it, these things will make you feel good. You know, I was just Googling what nootropics are, and they're known as smart drugs and cognitive enhancers. What a wonderful promise. And then these things don't, theoretically, don't give you a hangover or anything like that. But this can does caution that you're not meant to have 4 servings in 24 hours.
Right, which why?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think it is really interesting to see how many of these drinks have popped up in the past couple of brands, I guess, have popped up in the past couple of years, and that there is this growing interest in them, too, as it's not something that's kind of going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't know. I find that the issue with it for me is that there are all these, there seems to be, I know that there are people that are questioning it, but there seems to be less questioning than there should be. Like, if this is safe, right, then why is there a warning that's important? Not intended for use by children, pregnant, or nursing people, for those with a medical condition or taking medication. What kind of medication? I take medication. What medication? Heart medication?
Right.
You know, blood thinners? What if you take anxiety medication? Medication? Literally, I take medication.
Yeah.
Consult a healthcare professional before you use. But what if I bring this to my healthcare professional? If I take this, if my good friend Ryan, who's a doctor, if I bring this to him, he'd be like, bro, this is a bunch of fucking shit. I don't know what it does. Like, yeah, don't drink it.
Yeah.
And what he'll tell me is, you're fine to drink alcohol, right, which is what most doctors, I ask every doctor.
That's,
I'm like,
very ironic.
Yeah. I'm like, I'm going to be honest with you. I drink.
Yeah.
Like, I work in alcohol. I have definitely drinks most nights. I take some nights off, as we all know.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I probably, when I drink, Naomi and I split a bottle of wine. So mm-hmm. I'm having at least 2 to 3 glasses of wine.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. Like, most, because at least doctors know.
Yeah.
They know. Like, are you exercising? Are you living a balanced diet? Are you getting enough sleep? All this stuff. If I brought this to Ryan, he literally would say, dude, I do not know what any of this stuff does. I really cannot tell you if this is going to be good or bad for you, or how this is going to interact with any of the medications that you take. Like, he wouldn't know. And I don't know. It's like one of these things where and there's only like a few supplements in America that have been studied enough where we all think it's pretty okay to take. Something like fish oil, right? It's been studied so much that most doctors feel pretty confident in like recommending that most people take fish oil, unless you're eating a fish heavy diet, right? Like, we probably should have more omega-3s in our diet. Fish oil is a really easy way to add it. There's pretty much no bad side effect besides fishy breath.
Yeah.
Which is why a lot of them are
fishy burps.
Yeah, fishy burps. Which is why a lot of them have like the lemon oil in them or whatever. But like, that is something that we've studied. We haven't studied this at all. So to be very honest, this scares the shit out of me.
There's also a pretty big difference, you know, with this kind of product, where like, it is, you know, expressly or implicitly talking about affecting your brain function.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Hopefully in a positive direction. But I think that's the other thing, right, is something like fish oil is not intended to, you're not going to get high off it. It's not going to make you feel euphoria. I mean, if it does, hey, good for you, I guess. But for most of us, you know, whatever health benefits it has are much, you know, they're you know, sort of long-term and not non-impactful on your body. And also, it's obviously like a foodstuff that people eat all the time. And I do think that, you know, there is a big part of this conversation, you know, the reason why I think doctors would generally just say, we don't know, is because when it gets into things that affect your brain, like, your brain's real fucking complicated, and we don't know much about how it works, really. And certainly when you start introducing all of these other substances that have some effect on brain function, even if it's short term, yeah, we don't really know what that means. We don't know what that means long term. We don't know how it interacts with other, you know, kinds of, you know, especially if you're someone who takes, you know, yeah, anti-anxiety medication or things for depression or whatever, right? Like, all of that stuff does also affects your brain, obviously. So yeah, there's just a lot out here that is like unknown. And that doesn't mean it's bad. I mean, I think we need to be clear. Like, unknown is not the same as bad, but it's unknown. And it should be maybe treated with a touch more caution. I mean, clearly some of the language on here is like legal get language, like,
yes,
the Kin Euphorics people can say like, hey, we put a disclaimer on here. It's not our fault that someone didn't follow it. You know, that's just legal shit. But I do think that part of the reason for that is, yeah, we don't know how this works. That said, I'm kind of eager to figure out what it does to me. So
yeah. Well, and what do you have, Zach? You have something.
Oh, so I have the Bloom Beaming Joy.
What does it mean? Which, does it make you really happy?
I think there's actually two things about this that are really interesting. So one is that like the language around it talking about kind of, I guess, the flavor profile is inspired by your favorite all day rosé, only dreamier, glittering fusion of summer strawberry, barrel oak, and rosemary citrus, like a warm embrace with your toes in the sand. I mean, that sounds nice. And then it says open heart center and chill well for joyful intimacy.
Wait, that's so interesting that they actually chose to liken it to an alcoholic product.
I know.
I mean, I would say this entire category, and I've used this term before, is 100% yoga babble.
Yoga babble.
Yeah.
This entire category is yoga babble. Let me read ours. Open a portal to peace. Sparkling notes of lavender, vanilla, smoked sea salts, because I only want my sea salts smoked.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bath salts, on the other hand, I can just smoke
them.
And passion flower meet mind-calming ingredients to mellow you out and help you to transcend stress. Think naked forest bathing at midnight.
Right.
I don't want
to
be
have to think about that
at midnight. A stick will go up my ass and that'll be it. Like, I'm not interested in naked forest bathing. So okay. Gross. An owl will just, I'm not, sick. No. Okay, let me try this.
I'd be worried about leeches. Honestly, that'd be my biggest concern.
Ooh. Or like just all the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
I don't like okay, that. Well, so we're going to try these, right?
Already it smells like a organic food store in the mountains.
It does.
Like, you know what I mean? Like the bulk,
I'll be honest.
The bulk section.
It's got lavender.
Yeah.
This one actually smells pretty good.
Like a little bit of sarsaparilla vibe to it, root beer.
Kin. Isn't there a celebrity invested in this, in Kin?
I thought it was Katy Perry, but I don't think that's this.
At the very beginning, I was like, oh, this could be good. It tastes a little like root beer. And then it just gets real bad.
It's kind of like...
Tastes medicinal.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes like all the... Ooh. It tastes like all the supplements that are in it. Do you know what I mean? It's like, it tastes like if you were to take all the supplement powders and like mix them up and try and add some flavoring, but like you still taste that there's like vitamin, whatever
that
processing
like
guarana is.
Guarana taste or whatever.
Yeah. By the way, the celebrity is Bella Hadid, the supermodel.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
I don't think I would take most advice from Bella Hadid, but anyways.
But for lifestyle stuff, I mean, I think people do.
Obviously.
I think this whole thing kind of reminds me of like the vaping versus cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
Like, and everybody jumped over to vaping because they thought it'd be healthier and better for you. And I think they're...
And then we found all these reasons why it wasn't.
It's not good.
I mean, I don't know. Are you feeling anything?
I've had a lot of coffee today.
I mean, I feel a little bit of like...
I mean, how much of this do you think you'd have to drink to actually start feeling anything?
See, that's the thing is, I wonder if a
lot apparently...
of this...
Not
4 in 24 hours or less.
It would be real bad. I think a lot of it, I wonder how much of it is placebo.
Yeah,
I mean, also,
that's
like,
what I was also thinking.
Also, if you look at like the actual, okay, so like the proprietary blend, they don't tell you how much mushroom powder, reishi, you know, L-theanine and L-serine is in it. But they say the reishi powder is for easing of stress. I mean, there are people that like, you know, really believe in the mushroom stuff.
Yeah.
Then the L-theanine is for balance, for mind and body, and the L-tryptophan, which tryptophan is in
make
Turkey,
you sleepy, right?
Is serotonin. But then there's a fuck ton of actual B6 vitamin in this, like 294%.
And folate.
Yeah,
folate,
a fuck ton.
Yeah.
So like, I don't know what that actually is doing, but the B vitamins already are supposed to make you feel something. I don't know, man. My stomach just started to hurt.
Stop. This is a different placebo for Adam. He takes one sip of something with prebiotics in it, and he's like out the door.
Bye. Yeah, I don't know. Let us know if you've drank these things at podcast@vinepair.com. Yeah, this is a weird one.
Zach, how are you feeling?
I feel, I don't know if I'm blooming with joy, but I do feel beaming with joy. I'm not sure I want that to happen right now, honestly. But no, I mean, I think what's interesting about this is, you know, we've been talking, and obviously we've had a few different episodes and continue to talk about sort of the, you know, you mentioned before, Joanna, about the sort of connection to the NA beverage space and all that. And I think that there's no doubt that some of the crossover appeal here is like, it doesn't have alcohol in it, right? That might be for some people a selling point, and and all of the sort of you know, adaptogens and supplements and all that stuff is a selling point for some people. But I kind of come back to a question that I think we always have to ask with a lot of these products, which is, in the long run, if these things don't have really meaningful either health impacts or mood impacts or both, will people enjoy drinking them, and will it be seen as a sort of reasonable alternative for other beverages, mainly alcohol, especially when you factor in the cost? And, you know, this wasn't crazy expensive. I mean, the 8 ounce, I got a 4-pack of 8 ounce cans for $14. I guess that is pretty expensive. That's, you know, whatever, $3.50 a can for 8 ounces. It doesn't taste bad to me, but it doesn't taste that interesting either. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, maybe I'll report back, and maybe we'll all report back, you know, after we finish recording and be like, holy shit, I feel like a different person. Like, I can't get enough of this. Fuck your 4 cans and 24 hours limit. I'm just mainlining this until, I don't know, I go to the hospital or whatever. I do think that fundamentally, though, one of the interesting challenges for products like this is like, do they appeal to people from a straightforward flavor profile? And I do think that this one that I have tastes reasonably good. But again, it's just kind of hard for me to think about, like, unless it has these other effects also, will it be worth it to me? Because we already, as we talked about at the top, Adam mentioned, like, alcohol's negative side effects are oft discussed, mm-hmm. and not as often are the positive social effects for some people. And that is undeniably part of why some people like to drink. It's not just the taste.
Yeah.
It's not even just the sort of social kind of cachet. It's the way it makes them feel. And if beverages can't deliver at least one of those two, if not both, it's hard for me to see how they have any real meaningful market presence.
Right. This is why you hate hop water.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't taste good, and I don't get drunk. What's the point?
Yeah.
And it's expensive.
It's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. Let us know what you think about these adaptogen drinks. They are definitely
something.
Not for me.
Shocking.
No. They're...
What if I was just like, I crush a pack of Kinju Forks every weekend?
If you said that to me?
Yeah, would I be fired on the spot?
I don't want to put that out there right now.
Please don't.
I don't need to, like, have people coming for me. Not fair, Adam.
How about we just talk to you on Monday?
That's fine.
Have a great weekend, everybody.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for listening to the Vine Pair Podcast, the flagship podcast of the Vine Pair Podcast Network. If you love listening to this show, or even if you don't, but I really hope that you do, as much as we really do love making it, then please drop us a review or a rating wherever it is that you get your podcast, whether that be iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, anywhere. If you are listening to this on a device right now, through an app, however you got this audio, please drop a review. It really helps everyone else discover the show. And now for some totally awesome credits. So, the Vine Pair Podcast is recorded in our New York City headquarters and in Seattle, Washington, in Zach Chabal's basement. It is recorded by Zach, mastered, and produced by Zach. He loves all the credit. Keep giving it to him. Drop his name in the reviews. He's going to love hearing how much you love him. It is also recorded in New York City by our tastings director, Keith Beavers, who is the managing director of the entire Vine Pair Podcast Network. I'd also love to give a shout out to our editor-in-chief, Joanna Sciarrino, who joins us on every single podcast as our third and most important host. Thank you as well to the entire Vine Pair staff and everyone who's been involved in making Vine Pair as special as it's become. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next week.